He's a leaker today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A day after former FBI Director James Comey called him a liar, President Donald Trump fires back.
No collusion, no obstruction. He's a leaker.
Plus, what's next for the various investigations into Russian meddling in the U.S. election?
All I can tell you is that once the FBI starts looking, all bets are off.
We'll also do a deep dive into the shocking election results in Britain and hear from the man behind the Spanish language song topping charts all over the world.
You know, it's funny, I say it, I hear it, but I still don't comprehend it. I still don't go to bed saying, hey, 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 I have the biggest song in the world.
Despacito, that's ahead today on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. I can imagine a time when a White House press conference featuring the president of Romania was considered a non-news event. Sorry, Romania, no offense, but not this week in the Trump White House. President Trump's presser this afternoon with his Romanian counterpart, Klaus Iohannis, included some pointed questions from the press. And as you might expect, some of them had to do with this week's extraordinary congressional testimony from James Comey, who was fired by Trump as FBI director. Jonathan Carl of ABC News asked Trump about Comey's claim that the president demanded loyalty from him.
So he said those things under oath. Would you be willing to speak under oath to give your version of those events? 100%.
And I didn't say under oath. I hardly know the man. I'm not going to say, I want you to pledge allegiance. Who would do that? Who would ask a man to pledge allegiance under oath? I mean, think of it. I hardly know the man. It doesn't make sense. No, I didn't say that, and I didn't say the other.
So if Robert Mueller wanted to speak with you about that, you
would be glad to tell him exactly what I just told you, Joe.
And you seem to be hinting that there are recordings of those conversations.
I'm not hinting anything. I'll tell you about it over a very short period of time.
I've got the world's Matthew Bell with me here. Matthew, you followed the press conference for us. What exactly happened? What did you hear?
Well, this is a big deal. We've got Robert Mueller there, the reference to the special counsel and the investigation into Russian activities around the election and the possibility that maybe some of Trump's people had colluded. But Donald Trump was very clear. At one point when he was asked the first question about this, Marco, he looked down at the podium, presumably looking down at his notes, and he hit three talking points. He said, no collusion, no obstruction. He's a leaker. You know, this was kind of the driving point of the comments that he wanted to make today. It was interestingly, first opportunity he had to go beyond 140 characters on Twitter, and he didn't go much beyond that. I mean, he didn't want to get into details, I think.
Yeah, he kept it pretty brief. What else did we learn?
This tapes question came up. He sort of danced around that a bit. It wasn't entirely clear. We don't know what to think. Does he have tapes? Does he not? But then he repeated twice, I'm going to talk about that sometime in the near future. And then he said, but you'll be very disappointed with the answer. Trump pretty quickly wanted to change the subject. You know, he sort of made those points right at the beginning. And then he said, look, I'm trying to focus on things that are important for this administration. He said jobs. He said North Korea. He said the Middle East. And then he mocked the fake news, as he often does. He sort of mocked the journalists there. He said about the Comey affair, this is interesting. He said that this is just an attempt by the Democrats to sort of, he's suggesting, kind of redo the election. And this is all politics.
Sour grapes from losing the election last year. There were some pretty extraordinary things that James Comey said yesterday. Did Donald Trump appear to you flustered at all? How was his body language?
That's a good question. It's hard for me to tell, really. I think the thing that stood out to me was he said, on the one hand, James, we were very happy about the testimony yesterday. He's referring to people in the administration. He said, Comey vindicated me. He sort of verified a lot of what I said. But then Trump very quickly says, but then he said a lot of things that weren't true. So he sort of left it at that.
Again, Matthew, this is a press conference with a NATO member, Romania, the president of Romania, standing by Trump's side. And there were questions about NATO, including whether Trump supported Article 5, the all-for-one, one-for-all clause of the treaty. What did he say about that?
This is interesting. That question came from a Romanian reporter. You know, imagine sitting in Eastern Europe. This is obviously a place much closer to Russia. People there, you talk to them, they're going to bring up the threat that Russia might pose in much more vivid terms, I think, than a lot of Americans even realize. But when Donald Trump was in Europe, he didn't very clearly say that he supported Article 5 of the NATO treaty. Today he did. It was very clear, concise. He said that he would support that. The other interesting thing is this whole like broader question of a Russian threat came up. This really jumped out at me that one reporter asked both of these men to sort of characterize this threat. I mean, here is the American intelligence community consensus is that this was a huge problem in the American election. This is an opportunity to talk about it. Both presidents sort of passed on that question and kind of didn't get into it. I thought that was quite interesting.
The World's Matthew Bell. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marco.
Keeping up with all the ongoing investigations relating to Russia and the 2016 election, it can really make your head spin. There are at least 5 active government inquiries that we know of, all looking into Russian efforts to hack the vote and possible ties between Russia and the Trump campaign. David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones, and he's been sorting through the different probes.
The 3 major ones that people are mainly aware of or pay attention to are the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. There are some other subcommittees on the Hill that have been looking at different pieces of this. Then there is the FBI investigation. And the FBI investigation is now, most people know, being controlled by Robert Mueller after Jim Comey was fired from his FBI post. And so he's, again, looking into various aspects of this, and some may involve whether Trump associates engage in activity that was maybe not even related to Russia.
Well, how hard is it for you keeping all the strands of the investigations kind of cohesive in your mind?
It can be difficult because some parts of them don't seem to be related. There are issues involving Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who's not under investigation yet, but his involvement in the Bank of Cyprus, which was when he was working with a Russian oligarch. I mean, there are things that the congressional committees and the special prosecutor, the special counsel, the FBI may be looking at that we don't even know about. They are under no obligation to fully define their scopes. And once they start looking in one area, they may find other things. For instance, there have been reports that Donald Trump's personal attorney or the attorney at his business, Michael Cohen, is being looked at. Roger Stone as well, who was an unofficial advisor to the Trump campaign after being an official advisor to Donald Trump. It is very unwieldy. And we've seen in the past here that when you have a special counsel investigating, often they find things that are or aren't related and their investigations expand. All I can tell you is that once the FBI starts looking, all bets are off.
Can President Trump and the Department of Justice hinder any of these investigations if they choose to?
Well, that's the allegation that Jim Comey essentially made at his hearing. He said that he felt directed by Donald Trump to go easy on Michael Flynn, to knock him out of the Russia investigation, and to lift the cloud that was being created by the Russia investigation, which he interpreted to mean bring it to an end,
right,
one way or the other.
That would be obstruction of justice, but is there any hindrance of these investigations that wouldn't be illegal?
That's a very good question. The president runs the executive branch. The special counsel still works for the executive branch. So the president technically could try to fire him. This is what happened during Watergate, in a way, when Richard Nixon tried to fire the special prosecutor. So there are ways that the president could try to hinder these investigations, and some of those actions might end up being challenged in court, as what happened during Watergate when Richard Nixon would not turn over the famous Watergate tapes. And that case went all the way up to the Supreme Court that basically said, sorry, you're not a king, you're a president, you have to hand over this material.
So the 5 ongoing investigations are happening mostly out of the public spotlight. In fact, Mueller's final report, if there is a final report, will go to the Justice Department and may never be public. So how will we know what's going on or what happened?
Robert Mueller is not charged at the end of the day to explain to the public what he finds or doesn't find, particularly if he doesn't bring forward any criminal cases. It is a job of Congress, the congressional investigations, to oversee this and get to the truth and present it to the public.
David Korn is the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
There are other things going on in Washington besides Russia probes, etc. For example, while all cameras and microphones were trained on the Comey hearings this week, you may have missed a story the Trump administration really wanted to talk about: infrastructure.
For too long, America has poured trillions and trillions of dollars into rebuilding foreign countries while allowing our own country, the country that we love, and its infrastructure to fall into a state of total disrepair.
That was President Trump speaking earlier today. As part of what the White House is calling Infrastructure Week, Trump's been making a series of announcements, including one about modernizing air traffic. The president says he'll do that by handing over air traffic control to a private, nonprofit organization. The plan would rely on fees paid by aircraft operators. I asked Ashley Nunes about this. He's a research scientist at MIT's Center for Transportation and Logistics.
Well, what the president is proposing to do is to take about 30,000 employees that work in the air traffic organization at the Federal Aviation Administration and spin them off essentially into a private nonprofit organization. And the primary benefit associated with removing these individuals from the government structure is that currently it is very difficult for the government to procure, that is to buy technology and deploy that technology in a timely manner. And when we think about all the delays that we experience when airplanes are sitting on the tarmac, much of those delays are the result of not having the right technology at the right place at the right time.
So there are lots of nations around the world, including Canada, the UK, and New Zealand, that have similar plans already in place. How have they worked there?
That's correct. Over the last 30 years, there have been about 60 countries that have privatized their air traffic control service. All indications suggest that overall they have worked pretty well. Canada is often used as the gold standard. Certainly, multiple reports, both from government institutions as well as private institutions, show that the cost airlines pay for buying the air traffic control service has gone down over the last 20 years or so by between 20 to 40%. And as a result, the price that the airline passes along to the passenger is also lower.
Is there any reason a private air traffic control company, any reason it would be less safe than a public one?
There is no evidence to suggest that a private organization is less safe than one, you know, run by the government.
You know, Trump has spoken so much about infrastructure improvements for the U.S., highways, bridges, airports. Does it look to you like he's starting with airport traffic control towers as kind of the launch pad for all of these projects?
I think so. I mean, I the way it has been characterized, that Trump's announcement of air traffic control privatization, the way in which many people have characterized it is low-hanging fruit. And the reason why is because there have been efforts to privatize air traffic control for the better part of 30 years. Back during the Reagan administration, during the Clinton administration, to a certain extent during the Bush administration, and now. And it has always faced opposition. The difference in this case is the fact that it has buy-in from the unions, the labor unions that tend to be very powerful. So yes, I do think that, it's a way of kicking things off, but I also think it's probably the most logical place to start.
And a year from now, you think we'll have private air traffic controllers in place in the U.S.?
A year from now, no. I think it would take probably about 4 to 5 years.
That was Ashley Nunes with MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. The story behind the mega hit Despacito, that's coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. President Trump promised to ramp up immigration enforcement, and his administration is making good on that. In a change with the past, federal agents are increasingly detaining undocumented immigrants who have no criminal record. That's a case with two parents arrested recently in San Diego. Now their four children are on their own, while the parents are in detention. Tipa Fernandez recently visited the siblings at home to find out how they're managing on their own.
I'm out back of the small house where the four Duarte children live, standing beside a couple little ice cream push carts. Like his parents, Francisco Duarte, who's 19, started pushing one of these carts as a teen.
My mom and my dad met selling ice cream from push carts 20 years ago when they came to this country.
But since his parents' arrest, Francisco hasn't had time to take out his ice cream cart. In fact, It's mid-afternoon, and he's just now having breakfast.
I've been out all morning. We've just been hectic, doing as much as we can for our parents. So, yeah, breakfast at 2:37.
After he and his 12-year-old twin sisters watched their parents handcuffed and driven away by immigration agents, Francisco had no idea what to do. So he asked for help.
I went to my school, my high school, and I asked for references about this case, and they gave me a lot of good references.
They told him who to call, lawyers, immigrant advocates. As he scrambled to get his parents' legal help, his younger brother, Luis, who's 17, was digesting the news and stepping up to help too.
I just came home and I started cooking for my little sisters to get my mind off the situation.
What did you cook?
The only thing I could cook, eggs with ham. I mean, I'm not a chef or anything.
It was hitting the two older sons hard. They now had to keep up with school and run the household, keeping the house clean, making sure everyone's fed. Then they realized that rent was due in a few days.
When I went over there last Thursday, I asked him, how much money do you guys have?
Mark Lane is a legal assistant at an LA-based immigration law firm. He was one of the people Francisco called for help.
And he told me we have $2,500 in cash and we have to pay rent in 5 days.
Lane, whose firm has taken the case of Francisco's parents, also talked to the kids about all the expenses they'd need to pay. So the kids decided to turn to a terrain they know well, social media.
So recently, my parents were picked up by ICE and...
They created this short video, posted it to YouTube, Facebook and Twitter, and set up a GoFundMe fundraising page. They set a target of $10,000.
When it was started, we were at, every 10 minutes, we were at $1,000, and it was just amazing. We were so happy over this, because that's just one less thing on our plate that we have to worry about, which was money.
The kids set their fundraising goal at $70,000. Just days later, they reached that goal and surpassed it. More than $72,000 in donations have come in so far. They're stunned and grateful.
And it's just very uplifting that every day I get messages from people and they're just letting me know that they're there for me and that if there's anything that I need, that they're a phone call, text away for anything that does happen. I think that's from Mexico.
It's actually their dad calling from the detention center.
It's my dad.
Bueno.
Bueno, apa.
Muy bien, muy bien. Francisco tells his dad about the money coming in on GoFundMe.
De mucha gente, de maestros, de...
His dad wants to know who's donating. Teachers, neighbors, friends, people from around the city, he tells him. As the boys talk to their father, one of Luis's friends, Luz Maria Castañón, is here helping out.
He's going to be valedictorian, honestly. Nothing compared to his GPA.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen, another friend, Maria de Jesus, cooks up some tacos. Francisco comes into the kitchen. As he eats, his younger twin sisters are brought home from school by a neighbor. They both have the same sweet, kind of sad smile. Yareli speaks up.
So usually my mom would be here. She would sometimes have a little snack prepared.
They busy themselves putting things away.
Sometimes it is a bit overwhelming, but...
She trails off. 17-year-old Luis says he's headed out.
Oh, I'm going to go do laundry right now because our sheets are like really nasty.
Is that usually your job?
Nah, not really.
After the laundry, he has to be home for his sisters. His brother will be out gathering letters of support from people who knew his parents to help their immigration case.
I understand how hard it is to take care of little kids now.
And he heads out to get the sheets washed. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, San Diego.
Living in times when there's so much disagreement, how about something practically the whole planet seems to agree on? Yep, that tune. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito is in its fourth week at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. It was downloaded almost 70 million times in just 1 week recently. But the thing about Despacito, it's not just popular here. First, it went huge in Latin America. Then it started climbing to the top of the charts all over the planet. Does it give you an idea of Despacito's broad appeal? Shazam tells us it's currently the most downloaded song in both Saudi Arabia and Indonesia.
And how does it feel to sort of have the biggest song in the world?
That's the guy who wrote Despacito, Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi, speaking with the BBC.
You know, it's funny, I say it, I hear it, but I still don't comprehend it. I still don't go to bed saying, hey, 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 I have the biggest song in the world.
Fonsi says that when he wrote the tune, he had a simple concept in mind.
Sort of Latin up-tempo, mixing a little bit of what I do, which is a little bit more of the pop side, but giving it a little bit of that urban movement, which is so part of our culture now.
And that's rapper Daddy Yankee, the other Puerto Rican artist on the track. So the song was already super hot when Justin Bieber fell in love with Despacito. It was Bieber who approached Fonsi about making a new version with an English verse grafted to the top. My sunrise on the darkest day got me feeling some kind of way. Make me want to savor every moment slowly, slowly. You fit me, tailor made, love how you put it on. Got the only key, know how to turn it on. The way you never lie, my ear, the only words I want to hear. Baby, take it slow so we can last long. Luis Fonsi gives a lot of credit to Bieber for the song's success, but Bieber, hate to tell you this, there are lots of Despacito fans who think the song would have done just fine without you. Big thanks to the BBC's Paul Blake for sharing his interview with Luis Fonsi with us. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito, quiero desnudarte a besos despacito. Firmo las paredes de tu laberinto y hacer de tu cuerpo todo un manuscrito. I'm Marco Werman. In 1878, scientists flocked to the American West to view a total eclipse of the sun, and something changed.
We decided science is important. It's an important value to us. It's something our government should fund. But it was an important early event that turned America into the global leader in science.
American eclipse. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. These are uncertain times for Britain. Last year, the Brexit vote in favor of leaving the European Union. Then a new prime minister. Then just 7 weeks ago, that prime minister, Theresa May, called a surprise election. Her goal was to strengthen her hand as she negotiated Britain's exit from Europe. The poll suggested she'd win hands down. The vote held yesterday did not go as expected.
Theresa May's decision to call a general election appears to have backfired dramatically, with the country now
certain... Theresa May has apologised to Conservative MPs who lost their seats in last night's general election, but insists...
The UK faces a period of uncertainty after the Conservatives' slim majority was wiped out in the general election, leaving a hung parliament.
The World's Leo Hornack is in London. Leo, just explain, first of all, what a hung parliament is, please.
I think the best word for it is a draw. It means no one party has enough seats in the parliament to actually control it. And that means you need to start horse trading. It means you need to start thinking about the dreaded alliances, the dreaded coalition, which means no one gets what they want and everyone is unhappy.
So what happened last night? What did go so wrong and what led to this hung parliament?
Well, I think the rule with voting, you know, almost anywhere in the world now seems to be just expect the unexpected. What happened last night was many, many voters across the country basically turned against the establishment and the establishment candidates that they were offered. And they voted for a party led by someone who once would have been seen as a voice on the fringes. Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of the opposition, and he was expected to be wiped out in this election. And now he's made major gains. Now, I don't want to overstate this. Theresa May is still the prime minister. But as you said, she's just clinging on by her fingertips. And she's going to have to do a deal with a small Northern Irish party called the DUP, just to stay in power.
So listening to the returns last night, Leo, it just seemed like there were surprises at every turn for all the parties. Do we have any idea what changed that led to that?
Well, I think it's too early to say for certain. There's going to be many things that have changed. It's now an incredibly complex era of politics in Britain and in America as well. But there are some kind of broad outlines. And one that I found particularly interesting was the generational divide. You know, more than ever before, really, in living memory, the British are voting generation against generation. I mean, a quite in-depth poll looked at how different age categories of voters voted. And it was really noticeable that those under the age of 24 voted overwhelmingly by 2 out of 3 approximately for the left, for Jeremy Corbyn. Go to the other end of the age spectrum, over 65s overwhelmingly chose Theresa May's Conservative Party. So I think that's one of the real changes that you're beginning to see in British politics. And it has echoes, to my mind, with the US as well.
So Britain's about to start negotiating its new relationship with the start of Europe, Brexit, and the whole separation. How will the vote change that?
Well, Marco, I'm sorry to sound like a stuck record, but it's complicated. I mean, this was already like 8-dimensional chess, this Brexit negotiation. You have 27 European states negotiating with Britain about exactly how their relationship should be. And suddenly it's become like 10-dimensional chess, because Theresa May is going to have to be looking over her shoulder at every point and checking that her coalition partners are on board with everything she says. She's not going to have a free hand to be able to say what she wants in these negotiations.
Are there any scenarios whereby the British people will go back to the polls again?
That, Marco, is also very difficult to say. But I think there is a deep feeling of voting fatigue in this country at this stage. You have to remember that 2 years ago we had a general election, and then we had the Brexit referendum. And if you lived in Scotland, you'd also have gone through an independence referendum. And now we've had another general election. And it seems like an election which didn't produce a clear result for any one party. So I think there's a huge chunk of the electorate who are just thinking, for God's sake, please, why don't you go and sort out these problems and stop asking us to make decisions, because we've got our own lives to deal with.
Our man in London, Leo Hornack. It was just a year ago this month that Brits voted by a very slim majority to leave the European Union. Now, EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini says it's unclear what happens next.
1 year after the referendum, we still don't know the British position in the negotiations on Brexit, and it seems difficult to predict when we will, because democracy often requires time, and I very much respect that. It's a complex process.
But the negotiations between the UK and the EU are still set to start in 10 days. And Dan Roberts, The Guardian's Brexit policy editor, has been speculating about how they might go. Just help us out a little bit here, Dan. Explain why these election results last night threw everything with Brexit into such tumult.
Well, the thing they did most was really reveal a big flaw in the government's negotiating position. Theresa May went into this saying she was going to take a very hard stance in the negotiations. She was going to say that a no deal was better than a bad deal, that if things weren't good enough, she would just walk away. And the election result has basically revealed that not to be credible. Not only does she not have the political backing for that anymore, but she doesn't really have any economic arguments for why that would make sense for Britain. So she's left with a big hole in the middle of her negotiating strategy.
How much do you think last night's vote was a kind of last gasp, futile pushback against Brexit, kind of a second referendum that would never kind of really mean anything?
Well, I think there was a fair amount of that. I think crudely you could say that half the country was in the south of the country in particular, there was a vote against Brexit. We saw huge swings against the Tories, particularly in London and the southeast, where a lot of Conservative voters felt very angry about the kind of Brexit that they were being offered. The trouble was in the north of the country, the leaving are still quite popular, and Labour only managed to sort of cling on to some seats there by offering not much that different from the Tories. So there isn't a clear direction from the country yet to say, no, we don't want Brexit. But there's enough anxiety, I think, that a second referendum is not impossible.
A second referendum on Brexit?
Yes, I think what could play out is that the government might have to agree to put the terms of the deal back to the British public, i.e. that it may be that what we are offered by the EU is so different from what we were promised in the referendum, the first referendum, that there is overwhelming pressure to allow the country then to sort of sign off on it effectively. This would be at the end of the two-year negotiating phase. And that may well be a deal that proves so unpalatable that it's turned down. And I think that's what a lot of Remainers in this country and what some in Europe are still clinging on to here from last night's result.
There was one negotiator from Belgium who said, I thought surrealism was a Belgian innovation. I don't know what else you're saying. How are other EU officials taking this right now?
I think there's a mixture of sort of schadenfreude and sniggering and also some alarm that an already complicated process is going to be even more complicated by a weak British government.
I mean, it is ironic that the protagonists in the whole march to Brexit were this clique of conservatives and others, and now they can't really rule.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we've got an enormously divided country on this issue that's a once-in-a-lifetime one-way door. And I think it's very hard to achieve consensus on something as black and white as membership of a club like this, that once you go down that route, you can't turn back. So I think we may have to fall back on a lowest common denominator, that both sides might not get what they want, that we might not be able to leave fully, but we might not be able to remain fully either. We might have to find some sort of halfway house, a bit like Switzerland, a bit like Norway, perhaps, where we have one foot in, one foot out.
Yeah, well, listening to BBC 4 last night, it was just hearing so many incredible, it's amazing, what a shocker. What is it going to be like for you now on the Brexit beat?
Well, it's been a surreal few weeks, really, because this was an election that was called ostensibly about Brexit. Theresa May made it all about strengthening her mandate. But because there's been such a degree of denial about the hard choices ahead, we've had very little policy debate. And I'm hoping and expecting that things will get real quite fast now. We've got talks in 10 days' time that the government is in theory still committed to holding. And I think a lot of the really tricky issues that have been swept under the carpet until now will have to come out and get aired. And I think that will hopefully make my job a bit more interesting. But I think it'll also be good for British democracy.
Dan Roberts is the Brexit policy editor for The Guardian newspaper. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a real honour, it's a real privilege to be representing the people in the place where I was born and raised and lived, and my family live here. I'm in the constituency. I'm really excited to learn more and reconnect with communities.
That's a new MP for Birmingham Egdison, Preet Gill, the first female Sikh MP in the UK. She's part of the newly elected parliament, the most diverse parliament the country has ever seen. A record-breaking number of women MPs were elected. That really stands out. Fiona Rutherford is a BuzzFeed reporter. She's based in London. Put this into context for us, Fiona. How many women were elected yesterday and how many were there before yesterday?
Sure. So as you said, there were a record number of women MPs elected to represent us in the House of Commons. Last election, we elected 196 women MPs, but we've surpassed the 200 mark now, and there are 207 women MPs. So obviously people are celebrating, but as you can see, it's not a huge amount. It's only 32% of women in parliament compared to men.
Yeah, the record's been broken, but the gender gap in parliament is still pretty large. Has momentum stalled?
Do you know what? There are women's charities that have been campaigning for years and will continue to campaign to close this gap. There's one women's rights organisation, the Fawcett Society, and they're campaigning for the government to legislate to ensure that all parties put forward at least 45% women candidates in the future. So hopefully that will make a difference.
What do you think happened this time round with all these female victories? I mean, we saw a real push after Trump's election last November for young people, women especially, to get into the political game. Was there any push after Brexit for a change?
Do you know, I don't think there was a turning point. I think that young people this time round especially, they care about these things. They want to be represented. And the government has historically ignored young people and young voters. But we had a record number of young voters this time. And I think that people really do want to see themselves represented in Parliament. And I think maybe the result today reflected that. And it's not just women and young people, it's disabled people, it's different religious backgrounds. London is a very diverse city, but the rest of the UK is becoming even more multicultural.
Right. I mean, what you're saying is that the election was a win for a very diverse group of people.
We've had 10 newly elected MPs from ethnic minority backgrounds. So that brings the total figure up from 41 to 51 MPs. We've had the first turbaned Sikh MP, which is amazing. We've never seen that before. It's just a cause for celebration, but we do have a long way to go. And I think that even if you're not from an ethnic minority background, you still see the importance of having a parliament that represents the people in your town, in your city, in your schools, where you work. How long can we go with just a very male white parliament? It's just not going to help anyone.
So what does this new parliament mean for the UK going forward?
You know, it's okay having a diverse set of MPs, but we really have to make sure that they listen to the people of their constituencies, you know, and speak for people in the UK who are not usually represented. For example, having disabled people in Parliament can help bring these issues to the forefront and actually make some sort of effective change.
And with this diverse group of MPs representing these diverse backgrounds, is there a sense in the UK right now that they can push back against some of the sentiments that drove Brexit to victory?
I mean, yes and no. We can't really say. Everything's so uncertain at the moment and no one really knows which way Brexit is going to go. So it's hard to say. But whatever happens, we hope that the people who do represent us in Parliament and represent different religious groups, disabled people and women will make the best choices for the country.
BuzzFeed reporter Fiona Rutherford speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick look ahead to next week. We'll go to Morocco and hear about a woman who's breaking barriers with her surfboard.
They said to my mom, tell her to stop surfing, it's not good for her. But she told me, just go to surf, don't care about what they said. And then I keep surfing, you know? Like, if I keep thinking about what they said, I'm never gonna do, like, nothing.
But Mariam El Gardoum has proven all the haters wrong. We'll have her story, plus we'll take a close look at something called Odinism.
And essentially, this is the belief in the broad pantheon of Nordic gods from Odin and Thor and Freya. And you believe that they sort of led their lives in the correct way. And you try to emulate that during your time on Earth. I think that's the best way I can kind of sum it up.
But some white supremacists are now using it as their justification for their racism. More on that next week here on The World. Experiencing a total solar eclipse is mind-blowing. I've seen two. Science journalist David Barron has seen more than that. He has a new book out called American Eclipse. It's about one eclipse in particular, 1878, when America was just beginning to show what it could do in science. David says he became an eclipse lover, the word is umbrophile, after seeing his first total eclipse of the sun in 1998.
So here I was on the beach in Aruba, middle of the afternoon, and the partial eclipse is going on. The moon's moving in front of the sun. But then, just as we're approaching what's called the moment of totality, when the moon completely blocks the sun, suddenly everything is transformed. Day becomes twilight. The blue sky is stripped away. And at that point, and only that point, it is safe to look at the sun with the naked eye. So we had, my husband and I had been wearing these eclipse glasses. We took them off. I look at the sky, and it's transcendent. It's the sky I'd never seen.
We were talking just a few minutes before we came into the studio. I've seen two eclipses, and I was saying it's the closest I think you can come to space travel.
Absolutely.
The sun sets at 360 degrees all around you.
So all around you, it's orange on the horizon, but overhead, it's twilight. And effectively, you are looking to the middle of the solar system. It really is like space travel. It's like you've been transported to another planet, and you're looking back at the solar system. So you can see the sun, although it doesn't look like any sun you've ever seen, and you can see the planets together. And so for me, it was as if I was looking at a diagram from a high school textbook, like, oh, there's the sun,
right.
And I can see the planets, and oh yeah, the planets, they go around the sun, I felt so viscerally connected to the universe and just how immense it is. I got hooked.
So it is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
You've seen four eclipses since then. You'll see number 5 this summer.
Correct.
What drew you specifically to this eclipse in 1878 that you couldn't possibly have witnessed?
Right, absolutely. So back in the mid to late 1800s, total solar eclipses were not just natural spectacles to wonder at. They were really important to science because astronomers had reached a point in their research on the sun where they could start to ask questions and answer them about what is the sun? What is this enormous ball of fire in the sky? What is it made of? What fuels it? And the studies that they could do, they could only do during a total solar eclipse, which happens on average once every 18 months somewhere on the planet, often someplace very hard to get to, and it lasts for 2 or 3 minutes. So these astronomers would put together these vast expeditions, head off to the far corners of the Earth, wait in the path of the moon's shadow, hope that clouds didn't show up, and then frantically conduct their studies. 1878, the path of the eclipse crossed the American Wild West at a time when our country was really not respected in science. And American scientists wanted to show what we could do. So here was a total eclipse in our backyard. We were going to show Europe that we could do astronomy as well as they could.
So very conveniently, the path of totality, the shadow line carved out across the Earth by the movement of the moon in front of the sun, went right across the Transcontinental Railroad. So that must have enabled a lot of people, scientists, curiosity seekers, anybody, go watch it. What kind of publicity surrounded this eclipse at the time?
It was very similar to the way eclipses are treated today. The newspapers gave it front page coverage, showing where the eclipse would pass, giving advice on how to view it safely. Although back then they didn't have really safe eclipse viewers. They would advise people to use stained glass or smoked glass to look at the sun. And
right.
I would advise people not to do that. It's really not safe. But there was a lot of attention. There were eclipse tours that went out to the West to see it. People were very excited about it. And as I say, because of what was happening in America in terms of its intellectual development, it was this interesting melding of science and patriotism. The American public wanted the American scientists to succeed and for us to show Europe what we could do.
Well, one of the actors who was right in the lead on that was none other than Thomas Alva Edison. What was he trying to do with the eclipse?
So Thomas Edison, this is what really hooked me on the story, that Thomas Edison, age 31, right after he invented the phonograph and immediately before he invented the incandescent lamp, he went to Wyoming to see a total eclipse. And it's a part of his life story that doesn't get much attention because people pay more attention to the phonograph and the light bulb.
Right.
But it's this amazing little piece of Edison's life at a time when he was trying to show that he was not just an inventor, but he wanted to be a real scientist. And he befriended these academic scientists and he befriended astronomers. And he invented a device called the tezimeter, which was an incredibly sensitive heat detector, basically an electric thermometer, that he was going to use during the eclipse to study the solar corona, what we know today as the sun's outer atmosphere.
What was learned from this eclipse in 1878?
Well, it's interesting. You know, from a scientific standpoint, right afterwards, it was hailed as a great success because Thomas Edison's tezimeter found heat in the solar corona, and the tezimeter was going to be this next great invention. Really, the biggest news that came out of the eclipse of 1878 was that a U.S. astronomer named James Craig Watson found a planet called Vulcan, which was believed to exist between Mercury and the sun. It probably won't surprise you. Watson was wrong. And we know today that the tezimeter amounted to nothing. So in some ways, from a scientific standpoint, the eclipse of 1878 really didn't amount to anything. But from a societal standpoint, it was huge because it was an early event that really helped America coalesce around science, that we decided, this democratic nation, we decided science is important. It's something our government should fund. And it was not the only by any means, but it was an important early event that turned America into the global leader in science.
So this summer, another American eclipse on August 21st, cutting right through the U.S., northwest to southeast, middle of the day. The arc of it not too dissimilar either from the 1878 eclipse in your book. The High Plains also of Wyoming, once again, a great place to watch it. But a remarkable contrast with that belief in the late 1800s that science was the path to a better future. And now it's being debated in 2017 by the highest office in the land. What occurs to you?
Back in 1878, the eclipse helped inspire America's rise as a global scientific power. I think that this eclipse could have a similar effect, that is, to remind us of the importance and the wonder of science. And even though there are probably a lot of people hearing us right now who hadn't heard or hadn't heard very much about this, I promise you, come August, everyone will know about the total eclipse. Not only will this be the most witnessed total eclipse in U.S. history, no doubt, some people suggest it could be the biggest one-day mass migration in world history, because more than a third of the U.S. population, over 120 million people, live within an easy day's drive of the path of the moon's shadow. And as people wake up to what's about to happen, a lot of folks on August 21st are going to get up really early and drive into this path to witness this amazing event.
David Barron's new book, American Eclipse, was published this week. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
We have a preview of David's book and some really great pictures, too, at PRI.org. That is our show today. The world's theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.